The following is a presentation of the Matt Talk Podcast Network.
Welcome to On the Mat. I am Kyle Klingman of the National Wrestling Hall of Fame Dan Gable Museum. Along with our own refrigerator Jenga Andy Hamilton of TrackWrestling.com. Welcome to another edition, Andrew.
Thanks, Kyle. Good to be here inside my kitchen.
Yeah,
you were pretty impressed with the refrigerator Jenga that just transpired, I think, or
maybe you weren't impressed. Yeah, you seem to capture my imagination with some sayings, and maybe not all of them are yours, but I attribute them to you. So refrigerator Jenga will be one, golden unicorn will be one, and powder keg will be another one.
Powder keg of point scoring.
Point scoring. I think you used it with Joe Colon, maybe.
Yep.
Yeah, so okay. Those three, there are probably others that I will attribute in the future, but those are the three right now. And you using refrigerator Jenga, it just was so good visually, just hearing that. I knew exactly what you meant. And I don't know if you've used that before.
I haven't.
You just came up with it on the spot?
I did. That was the first thing I thought of when I looked in our refrigerator, and my girlfriend's daughter took something out of the fridge, and then looked like if you pulled one thing out, everything was going to crash down. Playing a little refrigerator Jenga there.
Nothing crashed.
Nope.
Yeah. Let's play some wrestling Jenga. Let's take out some pieces and see if we can keep all of this standing up straight, because we're now through the 2019 NCAA wrestling season. Penn State is still the juggernaut. They're the team to beat. And depending on what pieces are get pulled out on their Jenga puzzle, we're going to see where they stack up, but they're standing tall as ever right now. And even though a couple pieces from their Jenga have been taken out, and that's called Bo Nickel, that's called Jason Nolf, sounds like there were a few pieces that were going to get pulled, and we don't know if those pieces are going to be staying up or not. But regardless of what happens, we alluded to this the last show, Penn State is still loaded. They're absolutely loaded for the future. And it starts with Aaron Brooks, I think.
Aaron Brooks and all the guys that they signed a year ago, Top Flight recruiting class, they'll plug in some guys at the holes and continue being the team that everybody has to go track down. So whether it's Aaron Brooks, whether it's some powerful transfers coming in, you can expect that Penn State's going to put up 100-plus points, and that's going to be a team you're going to have to go chase, because they're probably not coming back to the pack. You're probably going to have to go run them down.
It's what it will take. Absolutely what it takes. And you only can compare Penn State right now to probably Iowa in recent memory. And Oklahoma State was that way, although we're in a different era. Oklahoma State went through 1971, and then they had a nice run from 03 to 06, had four in a row, but just that absolute powerhouse domination. What's 8 of 9 now that they've won?
Yep.
Starting in 2011, and then they had that 2015 where they redshirted all those guys. So I think there's always questions about what would that have looked like had they not redshirted those guys. But right now, it just doesn't seem like there's any end in sight. However, I think there are some teams, beginning with Iowa coming in next year, that really can compete with Penn State and make a nice run. I think Iowa does have the pieces in 2020 to make a championship run. And as long as you can stay healthy and have some of those question marks not be question marks by the end of the season, I think having Michael Kemmer is going to be a huge lift for those guys because of what he brings and the mentality. I don't think we've even seen close to the ceiling of Alex Marinelli. You get in Cassiopeia at heavyweight, and you have a formula for a team that can make a title run. I think they're going to be in the mix.
Yeah, and the caveat there, right, is if they can stay healthy, and that goes for everybody.
Yeah.
Because look at this year. Look at some of the guys that we lost early in the year. Michael Kemmer, to your point. I don't think Sam Stoll was ever close to full strength this season. You know, looking at other teams, Seth Gross wrestled one match. Kyle Cannell, his season got cut short. I mean, we lost a lot of top flight talent early in the year to season ending injuries. You know, Grant Leith was out once again. And so you just never know. I mean, that's the one thing we can't predict is who's going to be healthy throughout and who's going to be there when we get to Thursday morning on the third Thursday in March up in Minneapolis, and who's going to be up feeling good at that point. So, but if everything shakes out the way we think it will on paper, which it never does, but if it does, it could be a pretty fascinating team race. You know, like Oklahoma State's going to bring back a pretty strong team. You mentioned Iowa, Ohio State. You know, they look like, you know, for years to come, they're probably going to have a pretty strong roster as well. They've recruited really well. They got a pretty powerful recruiting class coming in that maybe some guys can help them instantly there at certain weight classes. So, really eager to see what 2020 brings.
Yeah, and Oklahoma State, they are a team that you don't want to say on the rise, but they're just really putting together some good teams, and they're entertaining teams. And I think that this last season, I think Oklahoma State really put a good product on the mat that you just enjoyed watching. And Dayton Fix is a big part of that because he was so good coming in and everyone knew what he was capable of doing. And I think he met those expectations, making it to the finals, head call pull away possibly from winning a championship, although Suriano, nothing away from him. What a fantastic run he had in the deepest weight class. So some things could have gone either way. Anytime you go into sudden victory, it means that one guy probably could win it if things went the right way. But Oklahoma State, I think, is in that position, like Iowa, to challenge Penn State. And as you said, Ohio State. So right now there's three teams that are knocking on the door. But outside of that, as we keep talking about, what's the team outside of those that's going to make the next push? Michigan's been there. Cornell's been there in the past. But is there going to be another team that's going to be coming through the ranks that we're not aware of that can make that championship run? And maybe it's Iowa State. We get a chance to talk to Brent Metcalf about that. They, I think, exceeded expectations this season, having 9 qualifiers, getting 2 All-Americans. And I think that in the next couple of years, you're going to see Iowa State saying we're going to be back to where we were in the 80s.
Yeah, I think they certainly had a good bounce back year this year and year two of the Dresser era. You talk about teams that maybe make the next move, and I think Michigan and Minnesota returned pretty strong cores. I think Arizona State, they took a big step back this year as far as their performance in dual meets and at the Pac-12 championships. But when you look at Arizona State, they redshirted Anthony Valencia. He'll be back. They redshirted Tanner Hall. He'll be back. They also have Colton Schultz waiting in the wings, guys like Ja'Cory Teamer ready to step in. I think Arizona State's a team that can make a big move next year.
Sure. And I think anytime you have a guy that you can pretty much count on making the finals, no way can you say that Valencia is going to win it next year, but enough evidence that you say, here's a guy that you know you can build off of. And I think that's the key to any successful program, is having guys that can make a championship run and you can build off of. And Arizona State is certainly that. What I'd just like to see more of is to see the Fresno States get in the mix. Let's get a few of those teams that are on the fringe, not just one team from each conference. And I think the Big 12 is coming. It's just going to take a little work, but I think it's going to be the Big 12 of old, where Iowa State's going to make a run. Not sure about OU, although they have some talent in the program, but get that 12-team conference back into the fold where they're pushing the Big 10 for some of those spots again.
Yeah, and then I'm going to sidetrack a little bit here, Kyle, but I didn't mention Cornell. Yeah. Cornell bringing Yanni Diakamahalos back, 2-time NCAA champ, Max Dean, a finalist this year, Vitaly Ruzhao. If they could get Ben Darmstadt healthy, he's a guy that could be in the mix for a potentially run to the finals at 97, scoring a lot of pins probably along the way. So that's a team that could make a move into trophy contention next year, I think. And know, they've got a strong recruiting class coming in as well.
Yeah. And as we look ahead to that, there's just so much on the horizon that, again, we don't know who's going to be coming through the high school ranks that could be making a difference. But as we think about Brent Metcalf and his run, we talk about that guy that was the nucleus. Brent Metcalf, who you've covered for a long time, and I mentioned this to you before the show, is just he's really changed my perception of him. And we'll get into some of those things as we get into the show. But you were around him a lot, and you got to see how he interacted with people. What do you remember about Brent Metcalf, who's going to be our guest today?
I found it kind of fascinating that there was sort of the many faces of Metcalf. And I wrote, I think that was actually the headline of a feature story I wrote about him when he was a senior, like going into his final tournament at Iowa was just, you know, you got a guy that we see as this steely, intense competitor, ferocious competitor. He's also a guy that will joke around with his teammates and likes to let loose. He hunts. He, you know, I learned a lot about him through that. He was exceptional in BMX racing as when he was young, and had a half pipe in his backyard and was into skating. And so there was just so many things about Brent Metcalf that, you know, if you just saw him as this uber intense competitor, you're only getting a fraction of the Brent Metcalf story.
And that's the way I saw it. So we'll have to get into who Brent Metcalf is and dive in. But as we look at just building on someone who's the nucleus, you can have a guy who is an NCAA champion caliber competitor. But during those years when Iowa was winning, 08 to 2010, Metcalf was the guy that was leading the charge, and they needed him at the forefront. I think that's the type of wrestler every program needs to build around, is someone that you can say, look at that guy right there. Look at that guy and what he's doing, and that's the example, and then everyone can follow him. Because a coach can only tell you so much, but internally to see that, and to see his style, and to know that if you were going to beat Metcalf, it was going to take absolute focus. It was going to take an all-in effort, and you weren't going to be able to get away with just one score.
Yeah, it's incredible how much things changed for Iowa wrestling when he arrived from Virginia Tech, when he transferred and that group came in. And I've always kind of said that, you know, when your best wrestler or your best athlete is also your best example, you can get somewhere in a hurry. If your best athlete is one of your worst examples, that's a recipe for disaster. And so when they brought Metcalf in and he was holding himself to the highest standard and holding his teammates to that standard as well, things really turned around inside that Iowa room in a hurry.
What do you remember about that year where he had to transfer and had to give up that year? It would have been the 2007 season. Do you remember what it was like in the room, how he was doing in the room, what people were saying about him during that, quote, second redshirt year where you couldn't compete? Could he have made a difference that year?
Well, I remember, he was going, toe-to-toe in some epic battles with Doug Schwab. And, you know, we're talking 2007. Doug Schwab was made his first world team, made a world team that year, finished fifth in the world and some tremendous scraps with Metcalf. Metcalf was going outside the country, up to Canada and overseas and having some pretty good success at the senior level during that first year. And so there was always that kind of, you think about where we were at that point, and Dustin Schlader had gone, 42-1 his true freshman year in 06. And they had such a terrific rivalry in high school and split a pair of matches as high school seniors. And so I think everybody was kind of wondering what's this rivalry going to become in college? And we were kind of denied of the opportunity to see Schlader at his absolute best early in his career, when Metcalf was redshirting, and then later in their careers when Metcalf was win in titles. Slater was dealing with injuries and things of that nature. And so, you know, that's kind of something where we thought we would see 4 years of knockdown, drag out battles between the two when Slater signed with Minnesota and Metcalf went off to Virginia Tech, and only get to see one of those matches, I think, in college.
One match.
You know, a Big Ten, was it Big Ten semi or Big Ten final, maybe?
Big Ten final. Yeah.
In 2008.
Yep.
I want to say. So
take that, though. It just feeds into a bigger question about rivalries. And we've seen some great college rivalries. Alger Jackson, even though we got that 1 year, and then it went international, Carr Monday. Is it fair to say already with one season to go, you take all of the great rivalries we've seen, Brands Freed, I want to make sure to throw that in there. Will Valencia Hall go down as one of the great rivalries in college wrestling?
You're a better guy to answer this question than me, because I don't know of too many people that have a better historical sense for our sport than you. But from my vantage point, yeah, I think so. Talking about, Zahid Valencia a year ago gave Kyle Dake his toughest battle from Final X on. And I think you could probably say that Zahid Valencia was certainly one of the 10 best guys in the world at 79 kilos last year, maybe one of the 5 best based on some of his results and, beating Derringer, taking Derringer out in 2 straight at the World Team Trials Challenge Tournament. Unbelievable performance that Zahid had there. Mark Hall, junior world champion 2 times, 3-time age group world champ, and guy that wins an NCAA title as a freshman. And now both guys have won matches. They've got multiple wins against the other. I think that's one of the things we talked about, rivalries. In order for something to be a rivalry, both sides have to have some success, I think. And
yeah,
those guys have. Those guys have both won a couple times against each other. I think, what is it now? Is it 3-2 in Zahid's favor now?
I believe so, yeah. So taking what you just said there, you said a couple times, so I don't know if you are going to hold to that. But based on what you're saying, would you say Hendricks Perry was a rivalry?
I mean, a rivalry, but I don't know that it was one of the all-time greats, just because Mark didn't have any success against him until the final match. Would have been fascinating to see another. What do we have, like 7 or 8 of those?
I think it was, yeah. At least seven, maybe two, or
3 more, if that would have gotten him over the hump and led to sustained success in that series, that would have been great to see. But unbelievable storyline, how that played out.
Yeah. But as we think about,
because like you go back to that match in Detroit in 07, there wasn't much going Mark Perry's way until he got that reversal with about a minute and 15 to go or something along those lines.
But go back and watch it. I mean, if you watch it, you see an absolute transformation. It was like,
once he got the reversal,
his mind switched and it's like, I got it.
Once he got the reversal. Yeah. And he got him broken down flat on the mat.
Yeah.
On his belly for one of the few times. And then he, of course, they stalemate it, I think, and go to the crab ride position where he got the count.
Yeah.
And like, then he really smelled blood at that point.
Yeah.
But like, Johnny Hendricks caused a lot of frustration for Mark Perry. I mean, he threw his shoes in the trash. Yeah. National Duels at one of those years. And there were a lot of times where Mark was like, seemed like he was in position maybe to win a match here or there against him. And Hendricks had always pulled the rug out from underneath him.
He'd always get it. But what is good about college wrestling, especially now, is that college wrestling, our product, we get to answer the unanswerable. And what I mean by that is I'm always fascinated by how would a college athlete do in the pros. We get to answer that question.
Yeah.
We have a barometer that says Kyle Snyder is not only the best collegiate wrestler, he is the best wrestler in the world. And we have conversations about, hey, how good would this guy do in the majors? Or if a major league guy went down, we get to answer all those questions to a certain degree. And I think even more so now, because how good is Dayton Fix? Well, we'll tell you how good he is because we have a barometer on the highest level. We know how he would do in the pros. because they are competing at that level. And I think that's a unique lane that wrestling has that a lot of other sports do not. Because I like to know, like, hey, how would Alabama football do against any pro team? What would that look like? It's a team sport, but we can answer that question, and we've had it answered. And I think we've gotten spoiled. I don't think we have a true appreciation for Kyle Snyder and what he did. I think we've just saw it happen, but I'm not sure that we have paid that full respect on how absolutely incredible it was what he did. To get second in the NCAA championships, then to win the Worlds later that year and beat an Olympic champion in the world team trials to make it, that's unheard of. So,
and you also think along these same lines is just what the regional training center allows us to do. I mean, you don't see like high school baseball players going up and, you know, high school pitchers pitching to Mike Trout.
Yeah.
You don't see like high school defensive backs trying to cover Odell Beckham Jr. Like we get to see that. Yeah, like we get to see these guys at the high school level. And it was like one of a couple of my favorite days in this business in whatever 20 years of covering wrestling were the two, three days I spent out at the Olympic Training Center for my first world team camp a couple of years ago, where David Carr's rolling with Jason Nolf and James Green, and he's, you know, a high school junior at the time, getting ready to go into his senior year. And Gable Steveson is going toe-to-toe with Nick Gwizdowski and Kyle Snyder and scoring points and getting to his offense. And that was a really enlightening opportunity for me. And it's really cool for me to see, like, these young guys not just being in this environment, but trying to win, trying to score points, trying to get to their attacks and not taking a back seat. I think that that's probably like probably the big reason why we're seeing these young guys winning at such an early age now and having such success on the world stage is just because that they're in these environments and they're not looking to just survive. They're looking to get in there and have success.
That's a huge point that you made right there, because that's what Jay Jagger said about the RTCs. Is he said, you can have a round robin with one of the elite high school kids, a national champion at Ohio State, and Logan Stieber, who's a world champion. And so that could be your round robin, and that's your workout group for the day during an RTC practice. So yeah, where else do you see that where, like you said, hey, major league pitcher pitching to a high school kid? That just ain't gonna happen. Yeah.
Yep.
So wrestling, that's great point about the trajectory of why we're at that level. All right, we got to get to one last topic before we get to Brent Metcalf, and that's stalling.
Stalling, huh?
Okay. Yeah. We're not going to stall on this interview, but I'll tell you what, you had a great column, writing time column on track, and it related to a tweet that Tom Ryan, the head wrestling coach at Ohio State, had about stalling and about this subject, and you interweave some great thoughts about his coach, Dan Gable, who was known for wanting to call stalling. And there's actually, you referenced the statue is in a stalling pose. And so there's this debate, and one side says, let's get rid of stalling. The other side says stalling isn't called enough. What do you think the solution is? And what have you seen from other coaches, particularly Tom Ryan, about this subject?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know what the solution is. It's a fascinating topic to me. And certainly the Tom Ryan tweet it caught my attention for a lot of reasons. As you know, we just mentioned the Gable, like he wrestled for Gable. The Gable statue has a fist in the air. He was college roommates with Terry Brands. You go to an Iowa duel, you'll see Terry Brands with a fist in the air at some point wanting the, you know, official to call stalling. There are people that think that we need to call stalling more in college wrestling, and there are people that think we need to get rid of it altogether. And I understand both arguments. I appreciate both arguments. I think that one of the problems we have with stalling is everybody has a little bit different interpretation of it. You know, and you hear the argument, well, like, you know, stalling when you see it. Well, what I see stalling as is different than what you see stalling as. And there are 25 what, 24, 25 officials at the NCAA championships, I would guess. I mean, I don't know the exact number, but I'm guessing it's in that range. I'm guessing you probably get about 25 different interpretations of what stalling is. And so, you know, we bring up a lot of baseball analogies on this show. You know, we're both baseball fans, and my analogy with that would be, what, you know, could you imagine if every umpire in the major leagues had a different strike zone? And I mean, they do to a certain degree, but we're talking about like a quarter of an inch here, a half an inch there versus, you know, it's not like one ump calls the strike zone from the shoe tops to the knees, and another one from the knees to the waist, and another one from the waist to the bill of the cap. We've got some really interesting interpretations of what stalling is. And we've talked, you know, at times before about Mike Allen, you know, here in the Cedar Valley, legendary wrestling official. And his interpretation was, if one guy fires off three shots and the other guy fires off none, the guy who's been inactive, I'm going to hit him for stalling. If it's 4-1, I'm going to hit that guy for stalling. When there's a three shot discrepancy. So he's got it defined. And I think that's one of the problems that people have, is there's so much subjectivity with what is stalling. And then the other thing you bring into play now is, we've created so many scenarios for when stalling should be called, that, you know, at the drop down rule, the side headlock rule, the out of bounds, edge of the mat stuff, that it doesn't seem like officials call stalling in the middle of the mat as much as maybe they used to because of all the stuff going on. And so it's just really weird. Like, a lot of stuff that is strange to me about it. Nothing is a bigger pet peeve of mine in wrestling more than the token stall call against the guy who has taken all the risk for 6 minutes, and we get into the final minute, and the guy that's taken risk and scored a couple takedowns, and he's built his lead by putting points on the board, not by getting stall warnings against his opponent. And then all of a sudden, like, the other guy starts coming on in the end and picking up his pace and firing off shots. And then we hit the guy who's winning with a token stall call. And it's like, where was that the first 6 minutes? So, you know, we just don't see stalling called the same in the first minute of matches as we do in the last. And that bugs me a little bit with it. So,
and the out of bounds rules, just
the out of bounds rule is a mess right now.
Well, and you've been critical of us being too complicated, and you want more simplicity, and there's so much value in what you're saying there. But I don't know how you watch it, but I know that whenever I watch an out of bounds call, it's watch the action, and then it's just the drama of, okay, look over to the official, what's he going to call? Mm-hmm. So for that 2 seconds, you're like, all right, is he going to call action? And which guy is he going to call stalling on? And you don't know, because you've seen it go both ways. And there's just some frustration about, hey, a guy's overpowering you, he's walking you out and feels like he's imposing his will. And then the referee says, hey, that guy got called for stalling. And then you've seen it called the other way, where you say the guy's backing out. So,
yeah, really, and you look at like a couple of matches come to mind immediately at the NCAA championship, Sam Stoll and Mason Paris. And there were scenarios where one sequence, it's stalling on the guy backing out of bounds, and almost a carbon copy of the same scenario later in the match, and it's the guy pushing who gets hit for stalling. You know, Austin DeSanto and Luke Pletcher. I mean, DeSanto was taking a shot, you know, changing his levels, taking a shot, and he gets warned for pushing out of bounds. And I think there's just the thing that I always come back to is, like, if wrestling people don't understand why something is being called one way, like, how do we ever expect, like, a person flipping through the channels to understand what's going on and become a wrestling fan?
You can't.
And it's, yeah, there's just some really goofy things with stalling. It's goofy to me that we'll warn a guy on top for stalling while he's getting rewarded with riding time. That seems a little goofy to me. And you know, we'll see sequences where the bottom guy is stalling and nothing changes, and 15 seconds later they hit the top guy for stalling. And just a lot of stuff with it that's like, why, you know, why are we doing this? Why is this being called this way? And how do we streamline it more? If stalling is going to be part of the game, how do we streamline it more where this is exactly the way it's going to be called? And you see some people that game the system on the drop down rule, right? I mean, they'll drop down for a four count and just hang there and hang there and hang there. And then on the before it gets to a five count, they'll climb up the body on the edge. Yeah. You know, it's
everyone's game in the system. Yep. Yeah.
And I think that would. So why I wrote it is like the Tom Ryan tweeted it, a guy from the Iowa system that, you know, wrestled for Gable, and he says, get rid of it altogether. And I thought that was an interesting take. And Tom Ryan's got some interesting ideas, a bright guy with a progressive mind for the sport. And so I wanted to hear what he had to say about it. What would it look like? And cause I've heard this argument before, get rid of stalling. I haven't heard it as much as I've heard it lately. I've heard it quite a bit lately. And David Taylor said it on a 7 minutes interview, and go back a few years, John Smith mentioned it to me as well. And so my first question is, all right, you get rid of stalling. How do you police the guy that sneaks in a takedown early? Can he just run around the mat? And you get somebody as exceptionally fast. I'm going to throw these guys out as examples because I've never seen people that are faster on the mat than Sean Bunch and Kurt McHenry. And so what if somebody like that gets a takedown? We don't have any mechanism to force them to engage. Does it just become like more or less a game of tag out there where one guy's chasing the other? And
international rules were that way for a while. Of course, every international rule has gone through a cycle and we have good system now. But there was a time where, hey, Randy Lewis said, hey, I was going against a guy like Nate Carr. He would take me down and there was no incentive, no force parterre. He could just stand away and I wasn't going to catch him because I didn't really shoot that much. I needed someone to shoot in on me. And you had that rule change. And once you had force parterre, it changed the game. But it's a topic that needs to be fleshed out. We need to get some sort of consistency with it.
I don't think it's an easy answer.
It's not either. On this one.
It's really, really complicated. And so what do you do? I mean, I don't know. I mean, because you're talking a stall call, a point in some of these matches it's huge. So I don't know. I think you look at international wrestling right now, and I think they've got it right in a lot of things with the rule set, but they have the shot clock. Could we ever get to that? I've always said, like, to me, the best wrestling in college wrestling occurs in the final minute when one guy has a lead and he's been warned for stalling. So he has to hang in there and the other guy's trying to catch up. The other guy's chasing. You know, how do we duplicate that more throughout the match? Well, freestyle wrestling, because of the rule set, because of the activity clock, because of criteria. Now, somebody's always trailing. Somebody's always chasing. Creates great action throughout the match. I don't know. I mean, maybe, you know, maybe we in my perfect world would see 2 minutes, two scoreless minutes tick off the clock. And the last minute, the official decides to put somebody on the clock. The guy who is maybe been the passive wrestler of the two goes on the clock. He has a minute to score. He doesn't score. It's 1 point. And so then we're off the tracks a little bit as far as that 1-1 into the third, nothing's happening. We go into the tiebreaker and it's 1-1 and we've watched 8 minutes and we've seen two escapes.
It's not fun.
No,
it's not fun. No. But well, our guest, I'm guessing, didn't get called for stalling very often. I don't remember it happening.
He wasn't in 1-1 tiebreakers. I know that.
Yeah, he was putting it out there the whole time. Let's get to our guest today, Brent Metcalf. Our guest today, two-time NCAA wrestling champion and three-time finalist for the University of Iowa, two-time Big Ten champion, made 4 world teams during his international career. And get this, 228-0 record for Davison High School in Michigan. He's going to enter the Glenn Brand Wrestling Hall of Fame of Iowa on Friday, June 7th. His name is Brent Metcalf, and he is the head assistant coach at Iowa State University. How are you, Brent?
Hey, I'm doing good. Thanks a lot for having me, guys.
Great to have you on. How are you liking Ames, Iowa?
Oh, I love it a lot. It's been really great. I've really enjoyed kind of the transition over the last 2 years from a wrestling front, kind of going through that process. And it's been just a lot of fun to be a part of. And then obviously, you know, from my family's point of view, we're really loving this town. And it's a little bit smaller town feel, which I certainly love. And I think that my wife is starting to enjoy. And it's fun. You know, I've got kids that are starting to get into school age level. So they're kind of getting involved with their little groups and things. And so, yeah, it's been really great and all on the up and up.
Your favorite restaurant in Ames is which one?
Depends on what you're looking for. Like date night, definitely Aunt Ma's, which has been around for years and years and years. Breakfast used to be Provisions, which is a brand new. I think they started like the minute I moved into town is when they opened. But you know, my local gas station, believe it or not, Phillips 66, they opened a full kitchen inside of there. And I sat down one day and I ordered an omelet. And I tell you what, I don't know if you can beat that. So the place that I go for there, and they got breakfast burritos that are awesome. You know, my kind of go-to lately this last year or half year, whatever it's been since they've been open, has been the local Phillips 66 for breakfast.
Really? I didn't even know Phillips 66 served food.
No, I don't think most of them do serve food, but this is kind of a local guy. He doesn't live quite in my community, but kind of attached to my community. He opened a coffee shop over by Lowe's, and I think he owns that gas station. And they opened this one, remodeled the whole thing, and made like a dining area and a kitchen in there. And it's been awesome. I go in there for breakfast. It's basically literally about halfway point between my house and my office. And my house and my office is only about 4 minutes, so it's about a 2 minute drive.
Take us through that journey to get there. You wrestle at the University of Iowa, actually Virginia Tech. You start there at Virginia Tech. You redshirt. And then, of course, the transfer where you lose a year. You go 3 years at Iowa, part of the Hawkeye Wrestling Club. And then you're on your way out to Colorado Springs to work for Bill Zadek. And then you make a U-turn and you come back. I don't even think you started out there in Colorado Springs. What lured you back into college wrestling, into Ames, Iowa, of all places, to coach at Iowa State?
Well, I don't know. I think it was just a combination of a lot of things, you know. You know, after 2016, I had some offers to go to a lot of different places to be an assistant or have some sort of role. And I think I would have entertained a lot of those offers and I would have been willing to do that. But my wife was still getting her PhD at the time. And I didn't want to, you know, one, it was a huge sacrifice that we made as kind of a family for her to be able to do that. So I didn't want to put pressure on her and say, hey, you need to stop your PhD so that we can move. And then obviously I didn't want to, me personally, move away and have them, my family, stay here. So, you know, me leaving the state at the time just wasn't really an option, you know? So that first year, I actually worked as an assistant at Prairie High School while my wife finished her PhD. And I don't know exact date. I want to say like the fall, Phil had approached me about the USA Wrestling job, something that I was super, super excited about because I have a huge passion for freestyle wrestling. And it's something that even as a young kid, it was always my favorite thing to do, was to wrestle freestyle in the summer, you know? And just the flexibility basically when he proposed the job to me, I basically had the flexibility that I could stay in Iowa City all the way up and through my wife and finished her dissertation and her PhD. And so I actually worked for USA Wrestling, let's call it September, October. And I basically worked remotely. So I would go out there for training camps. I would go out there for maybe 4 or 5 days at a time and do some work. I would travel, you know, I traveled to Russia, did the Krasnoyarsk, you know, as a coach. And I could do all that kind of from home. And then once my wife graduated, we were going to move out there full time was kind of the plan, you know? And yeah, like you said it, right as, you know, our car was literally loaded up and we were headed out to Colorado and it was basically like, hey, we're going to go out there and we got to find a place to live. You know, we hadn't figured that kind of element out yet. And that day I got the call about this opportunity. And at the time, you know, it was something that was maybe hard to wrap my head around, but I've always been kind of an open-minded guy with a lot of things that I do. And I just never want to say no right away to things. You know, I want to kind of explore, and you know, you just never know. You never know what doors are going to open, you know? So I guess I came on campus that same day, talked to Coach Dresser. And I mean, ultimately I think it was the best decision. One, because I do have a family with three kids, and my wife was able to stay closer home. You know, we're less than 2 hours away from her family compared to it would have been like 12 hours in Colorado. So that's part of it. And then, you know, another major part was just the fact that I fell in love with the state of Iowa, you know, and I love living in the state. I love the passion that this state has for the sport of wrestling. Being in the sport of wrestling in this state is really special. And it's something I've really learned to love and enjoy. Just the passion that the people have for wrestling. They kind of, I've been all over the country, and nowhere do people really appreciate and respect, you know, what you do. I think that, you know, in other states, it's kind of a niche sport, if you want to call it. But in Iowa, it's a really big deal, and it's fun to be a part of that. So, you know, obviously a lot of played into that, but that's kind of literally how it all kind of went down for me.
Hey, a guy you had some scraps with, Mustafa Kaya, just won European gold medal, 70 kilos. Mm-hmm. When's the last time you thought about competing?
Probably, to be honest with you, when I lost the Mount Aero at the Olympic trials, you know, that's kind of when it was done for me, you know, not to take anything away, but I didn't, my ego wouldn't let me drop out of that tournament just because that's not the way I was raised. But kind of once that opportunity was gone to make that Olympic team, and it was done. And, I have always said that, you know, if I start losing sleep at night, and because I have my health still, I'm still pretty healthy. Just at the time, it just felt like that was the time I was going to go through 2016. I was going to win an Olympic gold medal and be done. Just because that didn't happen, at least how my mind works, it's just because that didn't happen doesn't mean I just go throw my hat in the ring just because I didn't achieve what I wanted. You know, because to me, I'm not going to be doing myself justice by just going through the motions and just doing it, right? It's got to be something that's eating me alive inside. And then it would make sense to do that. And I'd say since then, like I said, I can sleep at night. I think that I know that through my whole career that I did everything I possibly could within my power to put myself in the best situation as far as training, as far as the work that I did. You know, I don't look back and think, oh, I have regrets, but I wish I could have done that or this. You know, I think that there's some peace in that, you know what, I did it the darn best that I knew how, and I didn't get what I wanted, but I can live with that. And that's what I love about the sport of wrestling too, which is at the end of the day, you're the one held accountable, and win or lose, right? So when you lose, you don't get what you want. You know why? And it's because of you. And, you know, as long as you're okay with that, I think moving forward is just all right.
Going back to how you got started and just your journey, you talked about how you finally got to Iowa State University. For those who don't know, when I read your credentials, you're a 2-time national champion, 3-time finalist, but you missed out on a year. You redshirted at Virginia Tech, and then Tom Brands gets the job at the University of Iowa, and you had to sit out that year. Mm-hmm. So you did not get to compete your redshirt freshman year. Is that something that still gnaws at you?
No, it really doesn't. Again, I think I'm a pretty positive person. It's one of those things where if you had resentment about it, it probably ended up hurting you in the long run, you know? So it's one of those things where it's kind of how life played out at that time, and you got to kind of accept it, move on. And that's kind of what I did. And then at the end of the day, you know, when I look back and I reflect on it, it was probably one of the best things that ever happened to me, because during that year that I was ineligible, I had the opportunity to go over to Russia and wrestle and compete in a couple of different international tournaments where I did a pretty good job, and I lost to some guys that were, you know, world champion caliber. But I was like right there, like a takedown away, or I had to take down, you know, Sahin. I took him down. He went on to win the Olympics in 2008. I took him down at the buzzer, and they gave him points. It, you know, they screw you over there. But either way, when I just remember like coming back and, you know, kind of prepping for my first year, which was 07-08. I felt like just because that experience I had and how close I was to that high level of guys, I was like, I'm going to win the Nationals. Like, there's just no doubt in my mind. And I don't know. I mean, I did believe in myself, but I think that that was one thing that kind of put me over the edge and really set me up for maybe the career that I had, was kind of those opportunities I was able to take advantage of, only because I wasn't necessarily competing, you know, collegiately.
Who are a couple, three of the best guys you ever faced? Who are a couple of the three that you really enjoyed competing against?
Oh, I've been asked that question a lot, and I would say probably one of the best wrestlers I've ever wrestled was Garzon, the Cuban, who's actually, I think he's back competing again, the latest I saw. You know, talking about a guy that when I wrestled, and I was not quite my prime exactly, but I wasn't, you know, that young in the sport either, who I wrestled in Cuba one time, and he just whooped the living crap out of me, you know, like, I thought I was pretty good, and I just remember, like, standing there, and he'd be in front of me, and the next thing you know, he's around behind me. And I was just like, my God, what happened? And I remember walking off that mat and even thinking to myself, like, I don't even know where to begin on how I'm going to beat that guy, you know? Now, he was probably one of the, at least one of the most impressive wrestlers that I've ever wrestled, and I think if you know anything about his history, he probably would have been a multiple-time World Olympic champion if he didn't live in Cuba. You know, where I don't know his life history, but I know that he took pride. And basically, the guy would make every quarter or semifinal round, and then he'd lose, you know. I just picked that one, make it easy, that he's probably one of the most impressive guys. And I'm interested to see, you know, I don't know, Andy, maybe you could tell me if I'm right or wrong, but I think he made an announcement that he's coming back. I think he's at 74 kilo, maybe.
I think he was on the, I think he was on their World Cup roster at 74.
So, I mean, we'll see. He was actually at that time quite a bit older than me, so I'm not sure how old he is now, but the kind of story I had heard is, you know, he had a 2-year ban for taking, let's just call him bribes or whatever. And then, you know, they asked him to come back after 2 years, and they're like, you can't take bribes anymore. And he was like, well, then I'm not going to wrestle. So either they worked out a deal with him or he doesn't need to take bribes anymore. So we'll see. You know, I'm excited to see, you know, how he can perform, because he was a guy that, at least when I was going through, I remember watching. And I mean, it was lights out. I mean, it's 2010, my first world championship. In that quarter bracket was the Olympic champion, the Olympic silver, him, and then the world champion from the year before.
Wow.
And he beat every one of those guys, got through the quarter bracket, and then he stood out in front of Russia and didn't do a darn thing and let Russia double leg him twice. You know, so in my head, I just remember that was my first thing. I was like, geez, like, I wonder what that guy could have done.
You know?
Not that we need to talk about him all day, but
you, that's my story. Obviously had a lot of battles with Burroughs in college. What did you think he was capable of then? I mean, nobody probably predicts he's going to go on, win 5 world and Olympic titles and, you know, potentially more, but what did you think this guy's upside was?
Well, I wrestled Jordan, his red shirt year, which would have been the year I was ineligible. And it's funny. I had someone ask me the other day, they were talking about recruiting, and they said, you know, is it even possible for guys to just, you know, not really do much in high school and then just magically just become awesome, you know? And I said, well, yeah, I think Jordan's a pretty good example of that. You know, did he win a state title, or did he never win a
his
state
senior
title?
Year? Yeah. He won one. Yeah. I think he lost. He might've lost to Molinaro in the state finals as a junior, and then he won one as a senior.
Yeah. Okay. So you're talking about a kid that won one state title. And then the next year, I would say I was a pretty highly touted wrestler in my career, right? So I wrestled him his redshirt year. And it's funny, I've watched his flow stuff, and it's really interesting to see his perspective, because mine was kind of quite the same, except opposite. You know, I remember wrestling him, and I think he took me down twice. He might reverse me. I didn't major him, but it was like I wasn't close to losing, and I maybe won by 5 points or something. But I remember, like, when the match was done, I was like, holy crap, that kid's good. And it was one of those things where, like, oh, he's on my radar. Because I'm like, that kid is legit, and he's a guy that I'm going to have to start, like, worrying about and focusing on, you know, in my future, in my career, you know? And then we went on to wrestle, I think, 5 different times, which they were all really, really great battles. But he was always a guy that was always so dangerous, because if he could just get his hand to your leg, or really even just like a pinky, if he could get his pinky on your leg, he'd score. And I always knew that. So I always had to be, you know, people always tease me about wrestling with my hands down on the mat and stuff. And a lot of that was developed because of him, because if he got to you, you're in trouble. He's going to take you down, you know? So I always figured it was, you know, I graduated, and I remember talking to Manning a few times and being like, hey, I'm just telling you, that kid's going to be awesome when it comes to freestyle, because you got a boundary that guys can't go out of bounds anymore. I mean, he's going to be unbelievable. And then, you know, I give him a ton of credit, because he not only, you know, he was dangerous with his double leg, and then he developed so much more, you know, as far as his singles and picks and things and angles that he got to, that, you know, he really became a really dynamic wrestler. And one of the biggest, I obviously did train with, I mean, I trained with him at training center, but not like day to day. But one thing I always gave him a ton of credit for, and, you know, I tell a lot of my guys now, is, you know, they say, well, you know, Jordan's just gifted. He's just that. And, you know, he's way more than that. He's a guy that, you know, I worked really hard in the room, and I would say that he was right there with me, working just as hard, doing the extra sprints. You know, there were times in a workout, you know, I maybe thought this earlier on with him, you know, I'm like, well, eventually he's going to put his head down on the mat and quit, you know, and then I'm going to be able to beat him up. No, like, that just never happened. He always fought. He battled, whether it was sprints or lifting, or if we were wrestling a match, it didn't matter if I was up by 5 or what the case, or he was up by 5. You know, he competed the way that I would have competed, you know, and to me, that's what led to his success. Yeah, he's a gifted guy, and he's unbelievably strong and explosive. But he's got the heart, he's got kind of the grit that went along with it. And you combine those two things, you know, that's what you get out of that guy. So.
Yeah, you kind of touched upon this, but my next question was going to be, what's impressed you most about his evolution?
I would say, I mean, I don't know if impressed the word. To me, I had always expected it. You know, like, nothing surprised me, because I don't know, I feel like when you wrestle a guy, you could feel how good they are, even if you win, you know, like, even. All the times I beat him, I just knew what was there. And, you know, to me, I think that, you know, 26, right? Heck, my years are getting passed on me here. It's, what the heck? What year was it that he didn't place in the world? In the Olympics?
2016,
right?
Yep.
Yeah. When he lost, right?
Yep.
That was something where I was a little worried, and I don't know if disappointed is a word, because I'm not his coach or anything, but where he went down and he didn't come back and get third, and he certainly had the ability to, where I was a little worried. I was like, man, like, did he kind of lose some of that heart, you know, and I didn't really know. But I was really excited to see him kind of be able to come back and obviously wrestle to his potential the last 2 years here. So, yeah, he said it. His interviews are awesome, you know, as far as, you know, you can tell how he's being really creative to find ways to motivate himself and things, which you have to do, to kind of put a chip on his shoulder again, to get the most out of himself.
When we talk about matches and who you wrestled, one of the most interesting 3-match series you had was in college against Darian Caldwell. Because how many times do you have a situation where you get splayed and pinned, which, by the way, you did not get splayed and pinned, because as you look at the match, that was an erroneous call, but it did happen. So they called the fall on that. Then you tech fall him in the All-Star mate. Then you lose to him 11-6 in the finals. Mm-hmm. When you look at that 3-match series, give us your take on what happened against Darian Caldwell.
Well, I mean, I'm just giving you an honest opinion here. one, the kid's unbelievably talented, and you know, I give him a ton of credit. I think that first match, I would agree with you. I would have loved to see that match play out, because it wasn't quite over yet, I don't believe. The second match, I don't think it was a setup, but I think that it was a setup for maybe the way the season went, because the way that it played out, I tech-balled him, and I think it kind of put me at ease more than I needed to be, you know? Like, as far as your head, and obviously the metal game of wrestling is huge, where it's like, oh, you know, I've got that bug squashed, you know, if that makes sense. And obviously that didn't faze him at all, because he came ready to wrestle, you know, in the final match. And I mean, as far as evaluation, I think there's a lot of things that year. And just being honest with myself, I think I was probably looking past that, and that's not an excuse against him. He went out and won the match. But, you know, a lot of my training, they are so worried about trying to make the world team that year. You know, I was actually training during the collegiate season, thinking about making the world team. You know, how can I beat this guy and that guy? And maybe looking past him, you know, just like I said, you know, I tech-balled him, you know, preseason. And I think that was, you know, obviously a threat that year. And I may have possibly looked past him, you know. And that's just something that you got to, as an athlete, you kind of look back and evaluate. And that's something as a senior, I made adjustment to make sure I'm not getting too far ahead of my feet, you know. But I mean, how do I evaluate that series? I think you had a great matchup between, you know, myself, who was kind of a grinder, and himself, who could really throw some moves out there. And, you know, I give a ton of credit to him, and his coaching staff, obviously, that was able to basically turn that thing around in a 180. And, you know, he went out and actually executed the best match he could, which is to go out and attack. I don't think that your best bet probably isn't to try to hold on and win in the end, you know, against me. It's to score and keep scoring, you know, and that's what he did. So, you know, kudos to him.
That was in 2009, and Iowa was running through everyone, but had a pretty tight tournament, ended up beating Ohio State, even though you guys didn't have an individual NCAA champion. Yeah. And when you look back at that, just your personal journey in that tournament, was there added pressure there? I kind of remember you saying you didn't sleep very well, and there was just a lot of weight on your shoulders. Take us through that 2009 year in particular.
Well, I mean, no, I don't think there was a lot of added weight as far as like that match. I think that the way things played out. So I remember, like, after losing, you know, paying attention to the team score and then feeling like really crappy, because I think basically how it worked, like, if I had won, then we clinched the title. And then if I didn't win, there was like I think Herbert had to beat Pasillo. And I remember, like, after losing, then kind of realizing and being like, oh man, I might just put our team in a situation where we could lose, you know? So I became a huge Jake Herbert fan instantly. but no, I don't think it was any of that. I mean, again, there was a lot. I mean, really, I was probably doing some stupid things during that tournament, like training wise, you know, again, looking forward to what was 2 weeks away in my head, you know, with the US Open. And probably not putting myself in the best position possible to be the best I can be on that day, you know. But those are, again, things that you live through, you learn, and hell, maybe I could have done it all right and still lost. I mean, there's no excuse in that. So,
what's that like, being a Iowa Hawkeye wrestler? Not just the Hawkeye wrestler, but the guy that everyone's focusing on, and everyone wanted to interview you. It was a big deal. So after you lose or win, everyone, you got a big crowd around you. There's a media frenzy. What's it like to have that on your shoulders, to be able to just know, hey, people are going to be waiting for me, and there's going to be a throng of media wanting to know what I think?
Yeah. You know, it's funny. After I heard a lot of people said that I was a jerk and all this stuff, and I love that interview in particular. But I actually went back and I was doing something on YouTube or something, and it pulled up. So I went back and watched it. And I remember, funny, like, in the moment, and like your memory, like, I remember being so differently than, you know, however many years removed we are watching. I'm like, That was probably a little silly. But I don't know. I'll go off of my memory of that that moment. And I never saw it as pressure. You know, like just saying being at the face of the program. I didn't see it as a pressure. I saw it as a huge honor. And it was something that I was like really excited about and I enjoyed and I can remember. And the fact that like I got to set the pace for who we were, right? And I took a lot of ownership in that. In that like, and I don't even know if I could say, but like, I wanted to go and like show my friends and all my buddies, like, hey, here's how we do it, right? So then I went out and I went and performed, you know? So I didn't see that as pressure. I saw it as a great responsibility that I loved. I thought it was super cool that I was in a position in my life that I got to, not that I don't, because you got to coach and everything, but I just felt like a lot of times it's like I get to set the expectation and the pace and the style that we're going to be about. And I think that was really cool, you know? So that interview, I don't think it didn't bother me. I think at the time, I know that there was, you know, there was a lot of hate in there, but you got to understand too, at that point in time, you know, you do a lot of things with your mind to keep yourself motivated. You do a lot of things with your mind to keep you on edge so that you don't get relaxed and so that you don't have slip ups and guys close the gap on you. Right. So you kind of do a lot of self-talk and things, to kind of keep you on edge. And so part of that was probably that, like what I said in that interview, which was the whole world's rooting against you and the things that I was talking about, the whole world, and they all want me to lose and things like that. You know, that sort of self-talk, at least for me, kept me motivated. It kept me reminding, like, no matter every time I stepped on the mat, like I had to be ready to go because everyone's done it for me. This whole crowd's rooting against me. Like for whatever reason, that's what was working to keep me where I was at, you know? So that's probably was just and it's maybe exposing part of my mentality of where I was at, you know, in that point in time. So I don't know, that you walk through a tunnel and you got 30,000 people throwing trash and booing you, you know?
Well, and yeah, I think you had said something recently that, hey, it's not in everyone's consciousness, but some Iowa State people had said they maybe had seen the match where you shove Caldwell at the end and they were like, hey, what's going on here? Mm-hmm. Take us through what that's like to explain that now that there's some Iowa State people that maybe don't remember that.
Remember that situation in particular?
Yeah, or they watched the match and want to ask you about it.
Questions asked me about that. And, I don't even know if the people believe me, but you got to understand I'm a whistle guy and I was always trained that way. And that you never stop wrestling until the whistle blows. And it was, again, it was kind of a pride thing, you know, even growing up. It's like, I don't care if you're losing by 14, like you're going to keep wrestling all the way until that whistle blows. And then again, that's one of those things where like, then you can sleep at night, right? Because you don't know if you quit wrestling with 20 seconds left, you could have pinned the guy in 20 seconds. You don't know. You want that to eat you alive, or do you want to do your very best you can with all the time that's allotted? And then when it's over, it's over, you know? And that was really the situation in that map was, I knew, I think I was down. He might've like let me, I don't remember exactly what had happened. But I remember that there was like 10-ish seconds left to go. And I knew I was down by 5, which is pretty hard to come back, you know, unless you throw a guy on his head. So I remember when he cut me, he turned his back and ran. You know, I kind of thought that he was like just going to run in my stall for like the last little bit or whatever. So in my head, you know, I'm thinking, all right, I got short time. I'm going to just at least try to jump on his back. I think I was losing by 5. So in my head, like, all right, I'll only lose by 3, which is better than losing by 5, right? And I mean, I don't care who you are. There's no way that I could have predicted that he was turning to like run and do like a backflip, you know? So, I mean, in all honesty, I was in no way trying to ruin his celebration. I've said this before in interviews too, you know, I've lost plenty of times in my career and I think that I've showed that I can be a fine loser as well. So it was unfortunate kind of the way that played out. I guess it's easy to say, well, you knew you were going to lose. You should have just stood in the center and let him do his thing. But again, you got to know that, you know, what got me to where I was at was kind of quite the opposite attitude. you know? So, yeah, I guess that's where I'm at with that.
Brent, if memory serves me correct, there were some people that like wanted you DQ'd from the tournament, which if you lost your points, Ohio State wins the national title. Did that ever get back to you? Did that ever cross your mind?
No, not at that time. But about a week later, they put a committee together. And this probably has never been publicly said, but they were trying to remove my last year eligibility away from me as a punishment. So that was actually really scary because, you know, through this whole thing, I remember being on the conference call with these people and being like, are you people serious? Like, because of this, you want to remove another year of my eligibility away? And I remember the people on that phone call. I don't remember. There could have been murmurs about that, and I don't really remember it being like a valid threat. But I do know that a week later, I had to get on a conference call, and they were considering whether they were going to allow me to have my final year eligibility. And that was something that really worried me. I think it was solved quickly, and obviously they decided not to do that. Yeah.
Wow. Going way back to how you got into the sport, I've just learned recently that you had other interests that were outside of wrestling, which surprised me. But tell us, you were pretty good at a couple other things. Take us through your other outlets outside of wrestling.
Yeah, sure. So I guess growing up, I probably did a little bit of everything. I did from t-ball to soccer to, like I told you, I did BMX racing. I did swimming, diving, gymnastics, football. I actually did track. I pole vault was the one thing that I liked, and then they dropped my freshman year. They dropped a program, so I didn't want to do track anymore because I only liked pole vault. I was about, at least as a kid and growing up all the way through high school, about as much of a multi-sport athlete as you can get. And I did a little bit of everything. I think I started wrestling when I was 9 years old, and because I was wired that way, that I did like every sport, I tried everything, and a lot of them, like t-ball is an example, I didn't even make it past the t-ball phase because, one, I wasn't good at it, and two, like it was kind of boring to me, you know? So I actually think I signed up, and my dad probably made me go through the whole season, but my memory is like, I was checked out because I don't even know if I made it through a season in my head, you know? I was leaving school. I was in whatever elementary school, whatever you would have been in at the time, and walking out of school, and I found a flyer laying on the ground with a piece of paper with a really cool looking picture on it. It was, think of like our mascot was the Cardinals. It was like a Cardinal with like jacked up muscles and a singlet on him. Or I'm sorry, that was Jason. It was a Martian, which is even cooler, right? So think of like a Martian, like Marv the Martian. He was all jacked up with his singlet on, and I just thought like it was the coolest looking like logo I'd ever seen, you know? Didn't know anything about wrestling. I don't even think I knew what I was signing up for. And I took it home and was like, hey, I want to do this, whatever it is, I want to do it. So, you know, parents got me signed up, and I would say 2 weeks later is when I was kind of hooked, and I was just really lucky that, you know, the community that I grew up in, which is just ironic, just happened to be one of the best, like, kids clubs, which is different than kids club nowadays, you know. Now there's actual clubs. Then they're just, like, community clubs, you know. Like, the best community wrestling, like, in the state of Michigan was that club. So I kind of walked into, like, a really great kids program with a lot of great coaches, and was just really fortunate. I think, actually, you know, when I look back and think, wow, like, how lucky am I that just happened to be where I lived, you know?
And you were ranked third in BMX biking?
Yeah. So I told you that story. So yeah, I was a big BMX rider. So at the time, I don't know if you've ever seen it, but the BMX were like the tiny little wheels and tiny little seats. And it's probably like designated for little kids or something. But yeah, we traveled all over the country. I did BMX, and I think the last national tournament I went to, I was third, which made me ranked third in the country in BMX, and I had, like, sponsorship, like as much as you could be sponsored. I think I got like free clothing and like maybe like I think I had like some gear like on your bike, you know. So yeah, I was actually pretty good at BMX, and it would be interesting to hear my story, my parents' version of that, exactly how that withdrawal happened. But basically, yeah, we had gotten out of BMX and kind of fell right into wrestling. That one smooth transition.
Didn't you have like a half pipe in your backyard too? Like a skating park,
yeah,
almost?
Yeah, that was later, you know, when I got into high school. You know, as a little brother to your big brother who you look up to more than anything in the world, you do whatever he does, you know? And he had kind of went through a phase where he had gotten into skateboarding, which was just kind of random. So he brought home a skateboard one day and started skateboarding. Well, as a little brother, I was like, well, that looks cool. I want to do that, you know? So I went and got myself my own skateboard. And like anything, I think in any of the activities or sports and things I did, like I was just dead set on being the very best at skateboarding, right? So I went in the garage and I had like this rail. And then I built this like little mini box for myself so that I could jump on it and grind on it, do all these tricks and stuff. It felt like I spent the whole first summer just like learning how to do tricks and stuff in the front yard. And then we found out we had a skate park. So we'd go to the, you know, talk about athletes and, you know, it's funny now you talk to your athletes and you're like, hey, you need to go to class, get rest, and then come to practice, right? Well, when I was in high school, I would go to school all day. I'd get out of school and then I would go to the skate park and I would skate all day from, you know, class, let's say it's out of three, I skate from 3 until 5:30, and then I go to wrestling practice at 6. And in the springtime, that's what I did every single day. And then I think my senior year, I was so much into it. I was actually getting really good at it, that I taught my dad into building me a half pipe, and we had the agreement. I had to go earn a bunch of money. And like the surface for half pipes is like the most expensive part, you know, it's like double the price of the whole thing. So if I could raise the money to buy the surface, then my dad would buy the wood and he would build it and I could put my surface on it, you know? So that would have been like kind of the next evolution was, you know, learning how to do X Games half pipes, right? So built the half pipe, had that. It was funny. I just saw Jimmy Gillespie when we were out in Oregon. And we were out to dinner, and I go, hey, you remember recruiting me? And he goes, heck yeah, I did. You had the half pipe in the backyard. So kind of funny what people remember. And we had lights. We'd do it all night long. We had floodlights set up on all four corners, and we'd skate all night. We had a jukebox out there. And it's too bad I asked my mom for photos and videos. And back then, like, he didn't have cell phones, so if you didn't use like a wind up camera to take photos, you don't have any evidence, you know? So
it's crazy though, because I always saw you as the guy wearing the camouflage hats, and so I just thought you were all in on the hunting scene and fishing and listening to Hank Williams Jr. And to hear you skated and did half pipes and all these other outlets, mm-hmm. It's just hard for me to put those things together. So it's cool that you had that side of your personality.
Yeah, I think it's kind of like you're definitely a product of your environment. But in that way, I've always been kind of a chameleon a little bit, right? So I remember at Virginia Tech, I actually was roomed with a lot of Iowa guys. And, you know, they all came to school and they were listening to all this old George Strait and all this country music. And I was the big, like, hard rock, what you would imagine a skater would be into. And I couldn't stand it. I was like, guys, I hate it. You know, and sure enough, after a year, all I listen to now is George Strait and Eric Church and, you know, awesome country music. And I think the same thing probably happened, you know, when I moved to Iowa. I hunted a very few times. I had a buddy who was big into it. So, like, I just kind of appeased him and go hunting with him. Then I moved to Iowa and I was eating lunch one day when I first moved into town. And I had a random guy just come up to me like, hey, you're Metcalf, right? Yeah, how you doing? He goes, hey, I hear you're a big hunter. And I kind of look at him. I'm like, yeah, sure. Big hunter. Yeah. He goes, well, I got some ground. Do you want to go hunt on it? I was like, yeah, sure. I'd love to. Sure enough, like, I didn't know anything about hunting. But this guy had offered me some ground to go hunt on. So I went and got a bow and arrow and camo and everything. And I went and tried to figure it out, you know, and that was really cool because I kind of had a piece of property for 2 years that I got to trial and error on and really did a lot of stupid things as far as the hunting world goes. But it really, I kind of had to self-teach myself how to hunt just through, you know, making mistakes and things, you know. So, and then, of course, like anything else in my life, you know, once I started hunting, you know, I was convinced that I needed to become the world's best hunter, you know, the world's best skater and, you know, everything. But, so, oh, yeah.
And you truly didn't know who Gable was all through high school.
Yeah, it's funny. Yeah, someone asked that the other night. And yeah, I think the best thing I could say is, like I said, that, you know, the passion for wrestling in Iowa, and maybe something why maybe I can appreciate it more than most people is, you know, I grew up in more or less Flint, Michigan. So wrestling wasn't a big deal. Obviously, I was lucky. Like the high school I went to, we were very good. So I was in a pro, you know, in a high school that cared about wrestling. But even the students didn't. You know, we just kind of had our fans and things. But yeah, growing up, you kind of asked, like, well, you knew Tom and Terry. And, you know, I totally knew those guys because Roy Hall, who was my coach, you know, that just happened to be the VHS that he stuck in. He said, hey, this is how we wrestle. Do it like this. So yeah, I didn't, you know, when I came to Iowa, and I told you this too, that, you know, someone gave me like History of Iowa book, like, hey, read this, you need to know it. And that's kind of where I got, you know, the whole lowdown on, you know, basically the history of Iowa. Heck, you know, Iowa recruited me out of high school and I didn't even take a visit because it, to me, it was just another university. You know, I don't even think I had my head wrapped around, you know, exactly what that was at the time, you know. But whether that's good or bad, you know, I think it was good for me because I had a lot of interest in a lot of different things, and I think that kept me balanced, you know.
Well, Iowa State's made some progress in 1 year, so if you take from when you guys came on board until now, I think everyone has swiveled their head and said, how have they advanced so quickly? Will you answer that for us? How have you advanced so quickly in one season?
Well, I guess maybe a couple things. You know, one, a lot of credit goes to the guys that have, you know, bought in right away. And like I had said earlier, you know, guys that were really excited, you know, obviously I'm coming in here and I'm excited about change, but they are too. And they're really motivated and you can see their excitement in, you know, getting themselves into a position where they're national contention, you know? So, you know, a lot of credit goes on them because obviously they have to do the work, you know? And then, you know, I think we benefited our freshman class this year, which was our freshman, you know, redshirt class last year. You know, as we were going through that season, I knew that a lot of those guys on that team were going to make an immediate impact. I didn't know how big of an impact, but, you know, just the way that you watch them compete in the room and stuff, you know, they were very much in line with kind of the philosophy that we were teaching and just the way that they wrestled and how they competed. So I don't think it was much of a surprise to me. But I think, you know, 15 was good, but, you know, there's still a whole nother jump to make, you know. You know, getting from the bottom of the barrel to here was really good, but, you know, still a lot of work and a lot of big things need to happen as far as, I guess, performance-wise, recruiting-wise, you know, all the different elements, to get into that top 10 and then top 5 and then ultimately, you know, national title contention. But it's good, you know, definitely heading the right way. I think that's something that you can feel really good about. And again, give credit to our guys for really embracing the challenge and the ideas and things that we kind of put at them and taking a hold of them and running with them.
Brent, you wrestled a lot of, or should say a lot, but you wrestled some guys at 149 who were tall and lanky. Does Jared Dagan remind you anybody that you faced?
Not really. The only guy that I could even compare him to was like Pataxical, I think. I don't even know how to say his name right.
Jake Pataxical.
Purdue kid, right, Jake? He, you know, his hands were so big. He was just a different type of threat because he would, like, you know, if he got your wrist, you're screwed. You could be up 15, you know, 14-0. And if he got your wrist on top, he was going to end the darn thing, you know? So he was a gangly guy like that, but Dagan is just, he's unorthodox in about everything that he does. You know, even, you know, talk about a 2-on-1, you know, you're trying to, oh, well, this is how you do a 2-on-1. And well, he just does it different. So it's hard to, for guys to feel, you know, when he grabs a hold of them, it doesn't feel like anything you've ever felt before. And then he can score in positions that don't seem like they're positions you should be able to score in. And I think the jump that he's really made this year is, you know, keeping that kind of style of his and then adding in, you know, being smart and being solid in positions. Because last year he'd get in trouble because he was, a lot of times those positions are things like, all right, you're either getting the takedown or you're going to your back, you know. And he did a really great job this year of making it so he either got the takedown or if it wasn't there, he got out. And then he, you know, lived to wrestle again another day, you know, sort of thing, get back in that position. So, you know, a lot of credit goes to him for making those adjustments. And he's gotten stronger and he's gotten, heck, we've been working 2 years on leg attack for him. And in the national tournament, he finally was hitting leg attack, you know. So, you know, as he continues to develop, I'll be really to see he's going to be a big threat, because if that kid can take guys down, like traditionally with leg attack, and then still have the ability to do kind of funky scrambles and things, and obviously he's very tough on top, good at on the bottom, wherever you put him, he's really good. He's going to be really, really darn tough. So, yeah.
David Carr, he's a special talent that I think a lot of people are looking forward to watching next season. What can we look forward to when we get to watch him compete for the first time as a Cyclone?
Yeah, I think that obviously with the legacy of his dad and his family name, the kid can wrestle. He's tough. He's very, very tough. So he's going to have his opportunity, and obviously he's, right now, he's kind of geared up toward making that junior world team and then winning a junior world title. And that's kind of where we have him right now. Like, hey, this is our next thing. Let's put energy into this. And I'm really excited for him for next year. He had this season was actually really good for him. You hate to have guys lose, but maybe the best thing to ever happen to him was, you know, he went out and he lost that first match just from being, again, Dagan-esque, like, reckless, you know, just being reckless. And just it was good for him to kind of see, like, hey, college is a little bit different level than, you know, strategically wise, you know, you wrestle this and that. And he made the adjustment, and he, you know, as the season went on, as the open tournaments went on, he really did a really great job. And excited to see him next year. He will definitely be a big impact guy, and a guy that'll be a great, again, another great example in the room, a guy that'll be another great example out on the mat.
What makes Kevin Dresser an effective coach?
It's been really, I sincerely mean it. Like, this has been a really, really fun thing for me to be a part of, because, you know, when I was in Iowa, as an athlete or as a club athlete, let's say, you're kind of a coach, you know, you're kind of working with guys and, you know, you're teaching, let's say that. But you don't, there's such a bigger business and, you know, there's so much more to it than just that. So it's been fun for me to work with Coach Dresser, because I would say he is a master at all of that. And every one of those pieces, he really, really does a really great job. And it's really highlighted for me, like, okay, the rest of the room is important and that's always the priority. But these other pieces have to have priority as well. And they are just as equally as important, whether it's recruiting or the fundraising or the just social things that you do just to get people to show up, you know, all these different little things. And I think, you know, obviously through his years of experience, I think that, you know, maybe his mindset and approach is definitely different than how I would have. But it's something that I've been really fortunate to be a part of, because it's, again, I'm an open-minded person. It's something where I can, like, oh, wow, like, it's not just wrestling. You don't just show up and teach wrestling every day and make guys tougher. You know, like, there's a lot more to it. And I'm going to guess, and obviously we haven't got to where we wanted to get yet, but a lot of that success will be because of a larger vision of it, and that it's more than just the wrestling. And that's not to say that, you know, I give him a ton of credit, too, this year, obviously, after the kind of transition we went through over the summer with coaches and stuff, he stepped in and was the major role of the transformation of this team this year and the training, and kind of put on display, like, hey, you know, I can put the best of them in the room too. And that was really fun to watch too, because now you've got, you know, a whole, not that much of a different, but a little bit different, like, training philosophy and things. And, you know, I give him a ton of credit for, not that he needs it, but, you know, just from outsider looking in, I guess, what he was able to do this year with this team. And those guys were, they were ready when it was time to get ready, and they were in shape, and they competed hard and everything that we asked of them. So hope that answered your question.
It does. And we want to end our interview with you by playing a game. We have a series of games. We have chosen a game for you called True or False. I'm going to give you five statements. Please answer true or false. And then if you'd like to elaborate on your reasoning behind the true or false, we would encourage that. Are you ready to play a game, Brent Metcalf, of true or false?
Let's do it. I love games.
Okay. Number one, true or false, BMX biking is more dangerous than wrestling.
False. I don't think wrestling is really all that dangerous. I never really got hurt doing BMX, but you are falling from the sky 10 plus feet sometimes, like onto a small wheel. So BMX is more dangerous.
Okay, so you're saying true.
Oh, all right. Sorry, false.
Yeah, okay.
All right. We know what you mean.
Okay. True or false?
Don't listen to what I say.
Okay. What I mean, okay. Just get your answer out of it. Okay. Number two, true or false, once a Hawkeye, always a Hawkeye?
Well, that's one hell of a question, isn't it?
That's not a question. It's a true or false.
Here's the thing. You got to say true. I'm not going to be a hater, and I'm not going to say that I'm rooting for their program, but you can't take away the influence and the experiences you've had in your life, regardless of what side you stand on. So, there's certainly been unbelievable experiences I had there at the University of Iowa, and they were great. And I don't think that you just forget them and say, you know, screw those guys and screw all that. You know, it meant nothing, because it was a really cool and a really awesome experience, and something that I was still am really proud of being a part of. So,
all right. Number three, true or false, the greatest wrestler under the Tom Brands era of Iowa wrestling is Brent Metcalf.
Well, you're not going to get me to admit to that.
Why not? You said you like games.
We'll see. Tom Brand's era has not ended. So,
well, current era.
I'll tell you one thing. Matt McDonough had an injury his last year. And I would say without that injury, it would be him. He'd be one of the greatest Hawkeyes of all time. So it's one of those things I'm always kind of looking back at. And I don't feel sorry for people, but one of those things where just situationally, and he's a kid that I always really loved to be around, and he had a hell of a career as well. So,
all right, so we'll give you an incomplete there. Number four, true or false, Iowa State will be walking on the raised stage at the 2022 NCAA Championships to receive a team trophy.
I'm going to do the I don't do predictions answer there. I see it in my head happening. But it's a part of making it come to fruition. And you know what? You got to see it. You got to believe it to have it happen. But we'll see. You know, these guys have done a great job, and I look forward to continue to help them strive towards that goal.
So we're going to say true inside your head. Can we say that?
Sure.
All right. Final one. True or false, Brent Metcalf reached his full potential as a wrestler.
True, no doubt. Do I still want to be an Olympic champion? Heck yeah. Do I think that Brent Metcalf could have been an Olympic champion? Heck yeah. Was I? No. But that doesn't mean that I didn't do it the very best I could, and every single day. So, yep.
Yeah. All right. That ends that game. The one thing game we want to see play is, like, could we get you somehow to do a skateboarding demonstration or something? Can we get that at before an Iowa State meet? I know they do the Matt and Beat, what do they do that? The Beauty and the Beast. Maybe we could have a little skateboard demo with Brent Metcalf before one of the meets.
Oh, a demo.
Yeah.
Yeah, heck yeah. I tell you what, though, don't pose that idea to the dresser because he might run with it. So, I'd do it, though. I'd practice. Give me about a month or so to kind of tune back up, and we could throw some rails out there and stuff, and I could probably get it. I'd definitely fall and wreck a few times, but that's kind of part of the amusement, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it'd be fun. So we'll get on that. Maybe we'll make sure Kevin knows about that. So, but
all right.
Thanks for joining us on the mat. We appreciate it. And we wish you all the best as Iowa State pursues championships in the future.
Hey, thank you very much. I appreciate the support, guys.
All right. That was Brent Metcalf, assistant coach at Iowa State University. And once again, this is why we do these interviews, Andrew, because you're able to see a side of someone, especially with Metcalf. You had said you had seen who he was all the way through interviewing him, but when I found out that he skateboarded and did BMX, that just floored me because I just saw him as the country boy can't survive. I would have had no idea that he didn't hunt until college. Just thought that was who he was. I just thought he was Hunter Fisher doing all that in high school, but here he's a guy that didn't even like country music till he got to college.
Yeah, there's a lot that probably the general wrestling public didn't know about him until maybe just recently, the last several years. You know, you hear that a lot, right? That, oh, we didn't know this about Metcalf, or we didn't, you know, he's different than the guy that we thought he was in college. And, you know, I got a chance to see a different side of him all throughout that process. A guy that would joke around, have fun with you. That was a lot of fun. That was like 55 minutes of like really interesting stuff. That was just a fun conversation. And those are the type of things that, like, you know, you, if you got a chance to spend time around him when he was at Iowa, I felt like you would get those type of conversations. And so, yeah, I had a chance when he was a senior. I know what Big Tens were up in Ann Arbor, and I got a chance to go up to Davison, spend some time with Roy Hall in the Davison wrestling room, and also spend some time with his family, you know, out on the farm where he grew up, and learned a lot about it, about him through telling that story, the BMX stuff, the skateboarding stuff. And you're right, there's a lot of different sides to Brent Metcalf.
I just saw the guy with the camo hat. That's what I saw. And I saw a guy that was out there and wanted to do his damage on the wrestling mat and provided a lot of entertainment. It's been an entertaining edition of On the Mat. Please join us again next week. For Andy Hamilton of Track Wrestling, I am Kyle Klingman. You have been listening to On the Mat.
This show is part of the Matt Talk Podcast Network. For more wrestling podcasts, head over to MattTalkOnline.com.